forget frequently asked questions.
Common sense, common knowledge, or Google.
How about advice from a real genius? 95% of people in any profession are good enough to be qualified and licensed. 5%
go above and beyond.
They become very good at what they do, but only
0.1%.
are real geniuses. Richard Jacobs has made it his life's mission to find them for you. He hunts down and interviews geniuses in every field. Sleep science, cancer, stem cells, ketogenic diets, and more. Here come the geniuses. This is the Finding Genius Podcast
with Richard Jacobs.
Hello, this is Richard Jacobs with the Finding Genius Podcast, now part of the Finding Genius Foundation. My guest is Professor John Coffin. He has a professor title with the American Cancer Society. He's also with Tufts University. So again, he's a research professor, a distinguished professor, deals with molecular biology and microbiology. We're going to talk about a very unusual topic that I don't know if a lot of people know, that it appears that humans have about 8% of DNA that comprises us that appears to have come from viruses that have become part of our DNA. I guess they call it endogenized viral DNA. I will get into that with John. Welcome. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for inviting me.
I got the name of it right, but this phenomenon of people's DNA also having what appears to be viral genes in it, what is that called in your parlance? And then we'll get into the details of it.
They're called endogenous retroviruses, or very often just abbreviated ERV or ERV.
Okay. How did you first come across the knowledge of this? Is this now common knowledge in molecular biology teaching? When you first saw this concept, where and when do you remember you seeing it, and how did it strike you?
Well, ERVs have been known. They were first discovered in certain experimental animals. Actually, chickens were probably the very first ones. And they were discovered because they basically, DNA sequences in chickens were found to be very closely related and in many ways identical to those of viruses that were already known to infect chickens. The virus of this group, the group is called retroviruses. It's a group of viruses that includes HIV and a bunch of others. And those were first discovered as viruses in chickens in the early part of the 20th century. The first papers on those were in 2007 or so. And they'd been studied for a long time. And then along in the 60s, as I said, some people discovered that there were closely related sequences already in the DNA of chickens, and those came to be known as endogenous, meaning they were already sort of inherent and innate in the genome. And as time went on, more and more of these were discovered in mice also, and then in many other species. Cats, for example, carry a lot of them. And the field really took off with the human genome sequence was published. And that's when it was observed that in the human genome sequence, there are, as you said, 8%, which is about 80,000 different bits and pieces of our genome, came from what were originally viruses that infected our very distant ancestors going back hundreds of millions of years.
So so there's sequences that are identifiable that are the same sequences that come from various viruses that would affect us, and affect chickens, other animals?
Yes, that's correct. And so they give us what is really a fossil record, if you think about it. It's the same as finding a virus in a genome is a lot like finding a fossil fish in rock somewhere.
Okay. So why would these viruses endogenize to become part of the DNA? Thought that, viruses people sick, they'll commandeer cells, reproduce, and move on. Why would they stay and become part of a genome of an animal?
Well, retroviruses work differently from most viruses that you might be thinking of. Retroviruses, and this includes HIV, in order to make more of themselves, and that's the job of a virus. The only job of a virus is to tell a cell to make more of itself. It's like a computer virus in that regard. The retroviruses do this a little differently from what other cells do, and that is for their replication, for their making more of themselves, or for instructing a cell to make more of themselves, and they actually copy their genome, which is originally RNA, into a molecule of DNA, and in order to replicate it, it has to first be integrated. The retroviruses, unlike all other things that we know about, these viruses have a machinery in them that inserts the DNA into the DNA of the host cell. And they have to work that way. If you block that, say, with a drug, then the virus doesn't replicate anymore. Drugs that block that particular step, the integration of the joining of the DNA the viral DNA into cell DNA are the inhibitors of that are some of our very best anti-HIV drugs.
Right, but again, why? Does anyone know why that virus is genetic?
It's what they evolved to do. Evolution have a goal. It is what it is, and if it works well, then it stays.
Yeah, but how would that decision be made?
It was made very, very long time ago, probably a billion years ago or so. There are retroviruses in the DNA of flies and clams. Many species have evidence.
What if I have I have the ABC virus as endogenized into my DNA. Mm-hmm. And today the ABC virus is around and, you know, let's say it's able to get into me and make me sick.
Right.
Why would it be able to do that? And it, you know, previous iterations of it, let's say, were endogenized. So why would does it prevent me from getting sick from exposure to that virus? An immune component?
That's actually a very good point. That's not good for the virus. That's good for the host. And that is that many of these endogenous viruses we've found over the years have the property that they can specifically block the replication of the same virus coming in from outside. And in fact, our laboratory is working with one of those right now that's in our DNA, probably evolved fairly recently to do that.
Okay, so I mean, do you think this could be, an adaptation by an organism to, again, protect itself against further attack by these same viruses, or?
That's correct. But it all starts like all evolution. It really starts with a chance event, and that is that the virus that had infected somebody infected the precursor to a germ cell, a sperm or an egg, and got into that DNA and therefore was inherited by all of the descendants that were derived from that original sperm or egg.
Yeah, but as soon as that organization would happen, like when CRISPR-Cas9 is used, you know, I would guess elements are snipped out, but maybe perhaps they're also added. But that would immediately change the epigenetic landscape. You know, you couldn't have the same marks. Maybe you could. I don't know if you had, you know, genes that are far enough away on the, you know, the DNA stream to not be affected, but stuff that's really proximal or close. Insertion is, it would change the game big time.
Right. Insertion of a frovirus can indeed have quite strong consequences. For example, we some years ago studied a mouse, a particular strain of mouse called hairless. And as its name implies, this mouse has no hair, but it's born without hair. That hair grows in, but then it all falls out very soon, only a little while later, and it never comes back. And we discovered that was because that the mutation that caused that was actually, the mouse was actually discovered by a night watchman in an aviary in London, who saw this funny, very funny looking nude mouse running across his floor. He picked it up, and he was a mouse breeder or mouse fancier as a hobby, and bred the mutation, and it's been studied ever since. It's actually very useful. It's actually a very useful mutation because it allowed testing of things like sunscreens and cosmetics, which otherwise be quite hard to do on a mouse because of all that hair. And but what we discovered, a fellow in my lab, this was many years ago now, back in the 80s actually, we discovered the reason that the mutation that caused that gene defect was of the insertion of a provirus into the gene, and that therefore disrupts, it's an insertion of about 10, a substantial chunk of the DNA into a gene, and you can imagine that could very often rather seriously disrupt the functioning of that gene, and that's what happened in this case.
Has anyone, well, I guess George Church, I know, was spoke to him years ago, but I guess they were looking at pigs and trying to remove the endogenized retroviruses. Do you know if anyone has done a study on, you know, the insertion or removal of an endogenized retrovirus? What happens, you know, again, to the creature in which this work has been done? Do they change dramatically? Do they, you know, again, are their epigenetic marks disturbed? Like what happens to the genetic material that's proximal to it?
Before we continue, I've been personally funding the Finding Genius podcast for 4.5 years now, which has led to 2,700 plus interviews of clinicians, researchers, scientists, CEOs, and other amazing people who are working to advance science and improve our lives and our world. Even though this podcast gets 100,000 plus downloads a month, we need your help to reach hundreds of thousands more worldwide. Please visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click on support us. We have 3 levels of membership from $10 to $49 a month, including perks such as the ability to see ahead in our interview calendar and ask questions of upcoming guests, transcripts of podcasts you're interested in, the ability to request specific topics or guests, and more. Visit findinggeniuspodcast.com and click support us today. Now back to the show.
Yeah, in general, no, but there probably are some cases where that where the provirus has taken on has some useful feature, for example, as you suggest, in modifying expression of nearby gene. And we've really just begun to scratch the surface. That's a difficult thing to study, and we've only just begun to scratch the surface on that. But there's some clear examples where that's known to be true. And so you would expect that those removing those would have some effect. But so far, as far as I know, in the pig case, where, as you say, George Church and others have been studiously working to get rid of those, as far as I know, there have been no real adverse effects. So I think it's probably safe to say that the vast majority of them are just there. They're without particularly doing anything, although certainly some of them do. And it's not only epigenetics. Some endogenous viruses in all mammals, although there are different ones in all mammals, encode what's called a syncytin, which is a retroviral gene. It's the gene that's on the surface of the virus particle, the protein that's on the surface of the virus particle that has the machinery that allows the virus to get into a cell by fusing its membrane with the cell membrane. And that has been accepted, is the word you used, to fill a very important function. And that is that when it's expressed on the surface of the placenta in the developing embryo, it causes the cells on the surface to fuse together into one, so they form a sort of solid sheet. And that helps to protect the developing embryo from toxins in the mother's blood, so that nothing can kind of leak between the cells, because there is no between the cells. They're all fused into one, basically into one cell with millions of nuclei. And so that anything that gets in from the mother's blood to the fetal blood has to be actively taken up by the cells on the surface and transported across. And that allows, that offers a significant level of protection to the developing fetus, and probably allows for a much longer gestation period than would otherwise have been possible. And that's what that probably allows, that then allowed the mammals to develop a much greater level of complexity than the reptilian or ancestors.
So is this coming from the organism itself that the viral DNA is endogenizing into? You know, viruses, some say are alive, some say are not, some say in this quasi state. Could it have come from evolutionary pressure from the virus, or from, again, the organism that's
not good for the virus? The best thing.
Well, maybe it is.
The best thing to, well, the virus is no longer functional. It's no longer functional.
Right, but future,
no longer functional of the virus. You could argue that its DNA lives on.
But what about future versions of it?
But the virus can't rise again from that.
What happens if you have an endogenized retrovirus, again, like the ABC virus, and then you're exposed to it? Would you get infected as strongly? Would you get infected at all?
Oh, okay. But again, as I said, protection against infection is also probably the most important function that in addition to the one I just mentioned, which is essential for normal development.
About when there's latency in viruses, they get into a creature and they're not in an active stage, they're latent, like herpes or the other ones, for years, sometimes lifetimes. That's a better state for the virus than being attacked and having to leave.
That's a different matter. I don't think latent viruses I can't think of any examples where latent viruses are doing the host any good.
Still they are there. Well,
they're there. They're there, sure. They're there to help the virus. And herpes viruses, it lets them lie low until such time as the conditions, for example, the host stress, substantial stress on the host when its immune system may be somewhat weakened, and then it can get out and replicate and have a better chance of getting to a high level so it can be transmitted to another host.
But has anyone looked to see if...
Becoming endogenous is not in general helpful to the virus. I think of the genome more as the graveyard of retroviruses rather than the goal of retroviruses, which some people do think of it that way, I must admit.
Right, but has anyone studied where, again, a virus is endogenized, and therefore either there's protection for that organism from infection, or maybe it pushes that virus to go into a latent state and stay there maybe forever, when otherwise it would have been virulent and attacked the, you know, the organism? Like, what the effects of endogenization when that same or similar viruses then go to infect?
You know, it's often true. And we, as I said, we're studying one of those, which is in the most recent group of these viruses that is that have infected humans and become endogenous. And it's still by recent, I mean half a million years, which is very recent in the sort of the time frame one thinks about when one thinks about endogenous viruses. But, and this is a virus that was actually entered our germline about 10 million years ago, because we have tools that we can use to date these viruses in a very nice way. It's sort of analogous to using strata of rocks to date fossils in a way. And so we know there's this one particular piece of virus DNA, and we know that because it's in exactly the same place in the genome in humans and in gorillas. And the property of these viruses, they can go almost anywhere in the DNA. They're not directed at any specific site in the DNA. So every time a cell gets infected, it goes into a different place. And so when you see two proviruses in the same place in two different species, that has to mean it was infected. It was already present in the common ancestor of those two species. The common ancestor of humans and gorillas is somewhere on the order of 8 to 12 million years ago.
Again, so does it appear to push viruses towards latency or towards just not infecting
at all? The latency of endogenous viruses is enforced partly by epigenetic means, and some of which are probably evolved by the host to suppress viruses from coming up if they're in the germline. Because in some cases, not in humans, but in some cases, mice, for example, there are viruses in the germline that are still completely intact and can cause infection that eventually kills the animal with cancer, usually. There's a virus in mice called mammary tumor virus that can be endogenous and can be passed as an endogenous element, genetic element, and it gets very strongly expressed in the mammary gland, and so it can be passed from one individual onto the offspring. But it can also cause mammary carcinoma, mammary cancer, breast cancer, if you like, in mice. Nice. And there are a couple other viruses in mice that actually can do the same kinds of things and cause leukemia, for example.
Interesting.
And in other cases...
Now, what is a disease-causing effect? What's the name for that? I don't know if you know it offhand, but I would think there's a term for it.
Well, for disease-causing, pathogenic is the word it's usually used. Just in general.
So it looks like there's multiple paths. So an infection can happen and the virus kills, you know, the host. Infection can happen, it can go latent. Infection can happen, it can cause these other pathologies that, you know, are not related necessarily to primary infection. And then I guess we haven't observed it, but, or maybe we are observing it, but endogenization, that's like a fourth path.
Right.
Is that accurate? These are at least the four paths that a viral infection can take?
Yeah, they're not necessarily mutually exclusive. You can have multiple things going on. Retroviruses are the only types of viruses that can regularly become endogenous this way, although fragments of other viruses have been found as endogenous elements as well.
I heard that in koalas, there's currently a retrovirus that's making its way through the population,
yep.
And it's changing over the entire population.
Yeah, the population, koalas being are at great risk for... Well, there's an AIDS-like disease that then makes them susceptible to other infections the way AIDS does, the way HIV does. And there's probably some cancers also associated with this. And that virus is also present as both an exogenous virus, that is to say, a virus that's transmitted from one animal to another, as well as can become endogenous. And koalas have quite a large, some koalas in some areas, have quite a large number of these in their DNA, in their germline DNA, in their inherited DNA.
So wouldn't be a nice thing, but would it be possible to take a koala that appears to be uninfected, bring it into the lab, expose it, and try to watch the endogenization happen in real time? Would that be a possibility?
That's actually been done in mice. In other species, well, it's obviously the practicality of it is quite hard, is quite difficult. You know, of course, you're working with an animal, it's not quite as easy to manipulate in large quantities as a laboratory mouse. But I guess as a thought experiment, it's possible. As I say, it has been observed in mice in the setting in experiments that were set up sort of specifically to favor it happening at a high frequency, which means you have to make sure the immune response is turned off at the right time and so on, because there's a specific time during life when the germline gets infected. It's actually it gets infected in the actually in the grandmother of the individual. It's going to be the first one that actually has it as an endogenous virus.
So what happened when this was done in mice? Was the endogenization able to be watched? You know, could they do sampling before and after? And then,
it's not exactly that way. You could do sampling of the mice you started with, and then sampling their offspring and seeing that there was an additional virus in the germline that wasn't there in the parents or in the.
Yeah, but you don't see it in the organism. Well, what happens in the organism itself before it reproduces?
So you don't see much going on. There's no good way to actually look at the individual cells where this is happening.
Well, what if you use an organoid? You know, what if you created various, mice organoids and then infected them?
You can infect, and that's been done. You can take, in the mouse again, you can take, say, fertilized eggs from the mouse, or take eggs from the mouse and fertilize them in culture and infect them with the virus and get them, then reimplant those eggs into foster mothers and see that you have created new endogenous proviruses that way. That was first done a long time ago, actually.
But what about in the existing animal itself?
Again, I don't think anybody has made any strong effort to actually visualize this in the animal. That's quite hard.
What about preferential tissue? I know it depends on, I'm sure it depends on the virus, but is there any way to tell which tissues would the endogenization would first occur in?
Well, if it's going to be endogenous, it has to be in the germline. So it has to be in the precursor cell, usually to a sperm or an egg, a cell that will.
Why would it have to do? Why can't?
Well, because otherwise it can't get into the germline. An endogenous virus is one that's in the germline.
There are things like in humans, prostosomes. I mean, there are exosomes or extracellular vesicles that are given off non-germline cells that then are taken into the germline. From what I've read in the literature,
well, that's
so that's a pathway,
but that's a different kind of phenomenon in a way. I mean, the germline cells, in fact, in an animal where this is going to occur, probably a very large number of cells in that animal are infected. Now, some viruses are amenable. Again, it's the analogy to a fossil record is very good because the fossil record only there's some animals that are very easily fossilized and some animals that are not. Partly because of their structure, animals that don't have bones don't make good fossils, for example. Animals that live in the wrong kind of environment don't make good fossils. You know, they need to be in the right place at the right time in order to become a fossil. And the same thing is true of retroviruses. HIV, for example, viruses like HIV have only extremely rarely been fossil and found in the germline and not in humans, only in a couple of species. And that's partly because they only affect a few cell types in the body. And
so there's a clue there. Like if you were able to know a certain virus will affect certain cell types, you could look at the extracellular vesicle profile given off by it and how that changes would be one clue.
Do that. That's an entirely different matter. As far as being becoming endogenized in the germline, the exosomes that give out won't necessarily be infectious. The virus has to have a certain structure for this to work. So if just the viral RNA, the viral genome is taken up into an exosome, that won't infect. That might be able to get into the cell, but it can leave.
Well, let's say it's already in the cell, and now the cell is giving off EVs that contain different genetic fragments, including maybe this would be part of the payload. And then they go into other cells, they're taken in, they're endogenized by other cells, and perhaps they can make their way to, the nucleus and then endogenize.
That would be a very, very low frequency. It's not impossible that that could happen. And in fact, you can take any DNA and inject it into a cell, which is essentially what you're talking about, And some very small fraction of that DNA will actually can actually also find its way into the cell's DNA. That's a very rare event. It's very low frequency. You can set up laboratory conditions so that happens. But that is perhaps a way that some kinds of genetic exchange have occurred. But that's much lower than the frequency with which we've seen endogenous viruses form.
So also, if it gets into sperm and egg, from what I understand, you know, in the process of fertilization, most epigenetic marks are removed. So I would think it would change that process. And how could this survive the removal of all those marks? Do you think the endogenous happens after that?
What happened before that, it would happen probably at an earlier stage of development of the germline cells.
Yeah, has anyone done that where you have sperm and egg separate? They've already been supposedly infected by, you know, this retrovirus. Now they come together and watch the blastula develop to see when you're seeing different effects.
Not to my knowledge.
Maybe that'd be interesting if you have unfertilized counterparts versus fertilized to see how it affects it.
It might be. The DNA in sperm and eggs may or may not be in a state in which, would, you know, in mature sperm and eggs that are ready for fertilization, may or may not be in a state in which it would be readily accessible, especially in sperm where it's probably very highly condensed and might be hard for the virus machinery to get at it. But I don't know the answer to that. Also, if you infect, the cell has to be amenable to infection too. And both of those.
I assume you had like billions of dollars in extra research funds laying around so you could look into all this.
I will put my next $1 billion toward that, I promise you.
Yeah, it just might be interesting. It would give clues perhaps on when this occurs and, you know, what stage of development, you know. Yeah, might be very interesting.
Could be interesting, yeah. Might be hard to get money to do it, although one imagines you could find some wealthy billionaire who would be interested in having his or her cells manipulated.
Right, in that way, yeah. So, what are some of the research questions that you're working heavily on?
One of them is, you know, exactly what we've been discussing. In fact, a couple of them are. We're very much interested in the effects that these endogenous viruses have had or do have on the animals or humans that carry them. And for example, we have, as I said, found one recently that has evolved with a number of interesting evolutionary steps to block, is such that it blocks the infection or the ability of a cell that's infected with the same virus from outside to produce new virus. And so it would be a protective in a way that's sort of different. It causes the virus. The genomes of viruses are very simple compared to the genome of the cell. There's very, very few genes. Retroviruses can have as few as 4 genes. And so in order to make a virus, you don't have a whole lot of different, you don't have a whole lot of different building blocks to work with. You only have a few protein sort of basic building blocks to assemble. So it's like Legos. You have to be able to take the same building blocks and use them over and over, use the same type of one over and over and over again and have them fit together in such a way that they build these structures, okay, that do a really remarkable series of jobs sometimes, like protect the virus from what's going on inside the cell, because the cells have a lot of signaling in them that can detect when a virus is coming in. So there's a constant arms race between viruses and cells, between viruses and their hosts, that you can see in evolution. And one of the beauties of endogenous viruses is that they let us infer some of the aspects of this arms race that have occurred over millions of years. Way back in our ancestry, these things arose up until, as I said, relatively recently, maybe the last half million years in some cases. And so the structure inside a virus, which contains all of the guts, basically contains the genomes and the enzymes and so on that are necessary to get the infection going, and also protect the whole thing from being sensed by the cell's machinery. The virus has a structure called a capsid, which is made of the same one protein, just used over and over and over again, and snapped together, if you like Legos, in a way that it can form a completely closed and tight structure. But if you think about that and you imagine that every once in a while you're making something out of Legos and every once in a while you come across one that where all of the parts that stick out have been sanded off. And then you try to build something, you build a tower with that. Well, you got something now which is not going to be able to accommodate. You can snap it onto the tower, but you can't build another, put another block onto it in any way to stay. And so that's, so when you, the weakness of something that's assembled like this often the same, even over and over again, is there's one bad one, it can destroy the whole, wreck the whole structure.
A question, what would it take to be able to, I don't think you'd watch it, but at least to get still images, you know, electron microscopy of a viral infection, you know, from start to finish.
Oh, there are lots of those. It's, although at some stages, with retroviruses like HIV now, those have gotten very good. There's some really nice studies now that are, where there are electron micrographs that can, and other kinds of visualization, not quite as pretty as electron micrograph, but sometimes very informative, where you can just see the virus as a colored dot moving around the cell, for example. And those have been used to very good effect recently to really, really give us a major increase in our knowledge of just what happens when these viruses get into a cell, what the steps have to be to get the virus from the outside of the cell into the nucleus, get its DNA made, and get the DNA out of the capsid and integrated into the cell DNA.
What have you seen when a virus enters a cell? Does it do random walk getting close to the nucleus? Are there any intracellular
defenses? It seems like it actually hitches a ride on the structures in a cell, which allow it to transport things around the cells. And it sort of hitches a ride along with those. It interacts with the machinery that's necessary to move things around the cell.
Okay.
And so it gets from the outside of the cell to the nucleus. And then what's recently been discovered is that it kind of sneaks its way through what's called the nuclear pores, which are the basically holes in the surface of the nucleus that communicate with the cytoplasm on the outside, you know, stuff in the cell that's not the nucleus. And machinery uses the cell machinery to push its way through the nuclear pore and into the nucleus. And then the DNA gets made, and then the capsid structure, which is holding everything together and keeping everything in a nice tight little bundle and separate from the outside of from the cell stuff that might sense it and alert the cell there's something wrong. That has to break down at the right point. And then almost immediately after that, the viral DNA integrates into the nucleus. And we've got now the very, very nice picture developing as to how that happens.
Do there appear to be any intracellular defenses?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's called innate immunity.
Once inside the cell, those cell evidence.
Cell, yeah. For example, DNA is not supposed to be in the cytoplasm of the cells. DNA should be, all DNA should be in the nucleus. So there are some, there's a very specific sensing mechanism that detects, you know, even a single molecule or a few molecules of DNA in the cytoplasm of the cell. It's there. There's a cell sensor that detects that and sends a signal, sends a chemical signal into the nucleus. And that then turns on a whole bunch of genes that are designed to simulate what's called the interferon response. And that can do everything. That then turns on a bunch of other genes, which can do things like degrade RNAs. It can cause the cell to actually die. Not such a nice outcome, but it's much better for the individual if that cell dies rather than that cell living and making virus. And that's called the innate immune response. And a lot of what the virus does, and that's part of this is part of the host virus arms race I talked about before. And so the virus has evolved this capsid, for example, that so that these sensing molecules can't get at what's inside. And so it's basically invisible to them and allows that whole process to take place without the cells picking up that it's there.
I don't think, does every virus, I would think, and many of the capsid will stay on the outer membrane and the payload will be injected, like a T4.
In some cases, that's true, but that's not usually true. In the case of retroviruses, there's an outer envelope, which is a piece of cell membrane, basically, that the virus took with it when it left the cell before, and that stays on the outside. But the capsids, well, what's released, unlike bacteriophages, you're thinking about the DNA is directly injected. But in these cases, the RNA, the genome, is still within this capsid. And that's not always true with all viruses. Different kinds of viruses accomplish often much the same things, but very differently.
So a capsid can be pulled into a cell during a viral infection. For some of them. And then once in the cell, what is signaling the capsid to then open up and release its payload once it's at the right spot.
That's something that people are still working on. The current idea is that in the case of retrovirus, and what happens with, coronaviruses and so on is a completely different story. But in the case of retroviruses, what seems to happen now, the current idea is that the RNA is copied by an enzyme called reverse transcriptase inside the capsid into a molecule of double-stranded DNA. So the RNA is just one strand, and that's sort of like, think of that as being like a piece of string. It's very flexible, can be packed in very tightly. DNA, however, is much stiffer. It's more like a thick rope in a sense. And so one of the ideas is that when the DNA is made, it just takes up so much more room that it pushes the capsid apart. That's probably much too slow for what really happens, but it's a good way, I think, to think about the process, that in that way the capsid can tell when it's time to open up and let the DNA out, when the DNA is pushing so hard from the inside. Much harder.
Has anyone been able to tag the capsid itself? So again, when the payload's released, once it's inside the cell, where do the capsids go? Does the cellular machinery, take out the garbage?
Probably. Nobody's been as interested in what happens with the capsid after the DNA is gone as they are in what happens to the DNA, of course.
Has there been experiments where you've done passaging of a virus? And, has anyone done surface analysis of the capsid over each successful infection event to see how it changes? Maybe that would give clues as to, how things are adapting with each
success. It changes very slowly. The capsid, one of the properties of the capsid structure is that it's quite difficult to mutate it because it's just such a highly evolved structure that even small changes, it has so many different functions. It has to protect the DNA. It has to probably somehow, it has to allow precursors for the DNA synthesis to get in and the waste products of the reaction to get out in a fairly specific way. It has to get through the nuclear pore, and it's just barely, in fact, it used to be thought it was too small to do that, but people, once it was realized that it does in fact go through the nuclear pore, people, experts in the nuclear pore, decided the pores were actually bigger than they thought they were. So but the virologists kind of forced the nuclear structure people to rethink their thinking. And so it has to do all of these things and a bunch more. So it's quite difficult to make changes. And different capsid proteins for different retroviruses, the amino acid sequence can look quite different. But when you actually look at the structure, it's almost exactly the same, which is very interesting.
Okay.
Well, they've all really probably somewhat divergent evolution, but when you have to make the changes in such a way that you preserve exactly the same structure. And so that's it's a very slow process of evolution is the point I'm trying to get to. You probably wouldn't be able to see much without putting selective pressure on. If you could put selective pressure.
But people are packaging of viruses deliberately to change them quickly. So sure. Why wouldn't you see it? So you're saying the slowest moving part of the virus change?
It's a slowly moving part, yes.
Okay.
And some of the enzymes are very slow to change, too.
Well, I mean, if I have a different payload, though, it would have a different structure, different molecule arrangements, et cetera. Wouldn't that change how the capsid can contain it and respond to it?
Well, yeah,
or maybe the capsid is flexible enough.
That would also be a very slow thing to change. And the structure is basically designed so that, with the exception of so a few small regions, one RNA molecule there's so many shared properties between RNA molecules that have actually different, quite different sequences that it doesn't really care too much what's in it. That's why you can use HIV to make genetic vectors, for example, to gene transfer vectors to transfer genes from one cell to another.
That's right, adenovirus, yeah.
And so you can put almost anything in there and it'll work so that the capsid is not sensitive to the particular details of what's inside, except to some extent for the size. But even with the size, they can accommodate quite a wide range of sizes.
Okay, well, very good.
We got lots more questions, but I know we don't have endless time, and I don't want to drive you nuts. But thank you for coming. What's the best way for people to find out more about your work? Where can they go?
Well, they can. Probably Google me. I have a Wikipedia page people could look at. Well, I didn't write it, but it's there. It's not too bad. And they could look me up at tufts.edu. There's a website, of course, for the university.
Excellent. Well, John, thanks so much for coming and talking about all these wide-ranging issues and being here. I really appreciate it.
Glad to talk to you.
If you like this podcast, please click the link in the description to subscribe and review us on iTunes.
You've been listening to the Finding Genius podcast with Richard Jacobs. If you like what you hear, be sure to review and subscribe to the Finding Genius podcast on iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And want to be smarter than everybody else? Become a premium member at findinggeniuspodcast.com. This podcast is for information only. No advice of any kind is being given. Any action you take or don't take as a result of listening is your sole responsibility. Consult professionals when advice is needed.